Hey, what's going on? Happy Monday. Happy Moth Day. The Toronto Blue Jays, they don't sweep the Athletics. They mop up 4 games. Not a 3-game sweep. 4-game. I guess a 2-game sweep by that extension would be like a Swiffer or a non-brand specific dusting.
Yeah. Maybe a dusting. Yeah, I like that.
The Athletics, get some. Jays win 4 of 4. They have won 5 in a row. Fun weekend down at the ballpark. Julia, you were there the whole time. How was cricket day?
5 in a row for the first time in forever, it feels like, but we'll talk about that.
First time since August. They did it in August of last year in a meaningless time of like they'd traded everyone away.
Probably that's why already. I don't remember it.
They have not won a 6th in a row, though, since 2023, and they have not won a 7th in a row since 2022. So history on the line Tuesday when the Phillies come to town. Zach Wheeler, look at, hey, the comment I've made before about momentum is as strong as your next day's starting pitcher.
Yeah.
Zach Wheeler.
Coming in.
That might be the anti, or not anti-Rays, the Rays, but in a person. Zach Wheeler, pretty
damn
fair. Good.
That's very fair. We'll see how that goes, but let's not get too ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, how was the weekend at the park?
Here. It was nice. Good crowds. I will say that it was awesome to see sort of the momentum shift yesterday because, you know, for the first time in a few games, the bats kind of started slow and picked it up late. And you could really see the difference in energy at that ballpark just because it had been so much early offense, right? Which is something that we weren't accustomed to either. But, you know, it's a good feeling. And I'm sure it's a good feeling to just be there as a fan and to know that right now, at least, your team can climb back and can keep chipping away even when things go wrong. I'm not sure that we were there with that confidence earlier on in the season. And yeah, where did you watch the game from yesterday?
From my couch.
Okay, and this is my question, really.
That sounded a very leading question, like I was going to get caught for watching the game somewhere scandalous.
No, listen, sometimes you watch it as a fan at the ballpark. Sometimes you're with friends, right? It varies is what I'm trying to say. But if you were at home and kind of like a little more locked in, let's say, than in a social event, I did want to ask you where your confidence level was with this offense after the Blue Jays fell or you know, were in a 3-0 hole early and didn't immediately come back to, because we saw them fall behind in, I think it was the previous game.
Well, they spotted them 3 in the first inning on Saturday and then immediately erased it.
There you go. And, you know, again, it kind of happens like that where they fall behind early. They couldn't get it done right away. And so we kind of had to all sit in the discomfort of seeing that 3-0 lead for a while there. And I'm just wondering, you know, earlier on in the season, it did feel like this would be insurmountable for this team. It doesn't feel like that anymore. And, you know, if you are looking ahead in any way in that game, where was your confidence level that the bats could find a way to bring it back?
Yeah, it was mostly fine. And it has as much to do with the Blue Jays as it does the Athletics. Like Justin Sterner and Grant Holman were getting up in the bullpen. It's a bullpen that came into this series with an ERA over 6 and ERA in the month of May over 9. If you are not going to have a level of confidence against that bullpen, you're not going to have a level of confidence against any situation. And yeah, this is an offense that struggled against, you know, Nathan Eovaldi comes out of a game early and Jacob Latz and company give you 7 innings of really good relief work. But if you're not going to have some confidence after the couple games that they had, after really the month of May that they had, because that week, like that road trip with Tampa Bay and Texas was really bad. They scored 6 runs over 6 games. They still ended up the month of May, one of the better offenses in baseball. So, you know, this is why we can't overreact each Monday. You kind of have to level head it. Yeah, but I mean, mostly it's my confidence was a level of disrespect for the pitchers that the Athletics had available to them to bring in. If it was a 4-2 game in the 9th, maybe Mason Miller gets a nod of respect from me, given the quality of the stuff and things like that. But the A's having, you know, at what point was it 3-0? Like, they had 15 outs to cover. And, you know, JP Sears is okay. The rest of the options they have are somewhere less than okay. So I felt pretty fine. And obviously, like, there's a bit of a hit in that you lose Dalton Varsho the day prior. You lost Anthony Santander earlier in the weekend. Nice to see fun faces and stuff. But it's not, you know, it's not like your A-plus lineup is in there. But still, this is a I mean, this is good eating for a four game series, and that was very front of mind.
Yeah, I also wondered how much the Dalton Varsho news would have an effect, not just obviously in the lineup, but in the mentality, right? Because we've seen this team sort of get down on itself in the past. And this, I think, Blake, is where we can actually start to quantify some of the things that these hitters have been saying, in the sense that the mentality around this team is different this year. And
but what does that mean, though? Because, like, we did a whole deep dive on, like, the numbers underneath the approach and the batted balls and where the gap was between the success last week. But, like, the platitudes of, like, and, like, I don't mean this to pick on John Schneider. Obviously, he's going to say positive things about his team after the weekend. But, like, you ask the 15 managers who won series this weekend, they probably all say, you know, guys are in good routines and guys are, you know, sticking to the game plan and stuff like that. So, like, what does that mean either to you or to the Blue Jays to say that? Because a week before, those things weren't true because they'd hit poorly, and now they're true because they hit. You know what I mean? There's like, it's like a little bit of self-fulfilling. It's only true when the bats are going well, but the routines weren't different a week ago.
So let me ask you this. When you have a bad show here, which happens very infrequently because you're very good at what you do, how often does that carry over to the next show? That's kind of where, you know, Ernie Clement a few weeks ago said something along the lines of, when we were down by 2 last year, it felt like we were down by 10. This year, it does not feel like that. There is an element of culture, of collective mindset, of we are not out of this. That does matter when you get into a game and when you step up to the plate. It does. Motivation is a big part of this sport.
It matters, but it is easier for that to manifest against Justin Sterner
than
it is to manifest against, you know, I don't know, whatever. I guess it should have probably manifested against 3 innings of Jacob Latz in the Rangers series. And this is kind of my point. It's like those things are good, but like if they're actually true and sustaining, we should be talking about them after the bad week too. Like they only seem to exist when things have gone well, which is, again, it's like, you know, if you judge a 3-point shot, you got to judge it when it's in the air, not if it goes through the basket or not. So I don't know. It's like even last week when things were bad and they were coming out of the series, we did a whole thing like looking at some of the positives in the underlying, some of the gaps where, hey, this is why it's not lining up. That stuff to me is just like, and I know we differ on that. That stuff to me is more real, like the underlying process, the swing decisions were good. The quality of contact was good. Some stuff with the bad angle and the quality of batted ball and the direction of batted wasn't all the way there. But for the most part, they were checking the boxes of good approach at the plate. You know, we had gone through a bunch of examples, whether it's Ernie Clement, Bo Bichette, this is how pitchers are attacking you. This is what they've got to be ready for. This is the change we've seen. That stuff to me is just more real than, or not more real, but easier to analyze.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, it's there whether they win or lose.
Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, optimism and good vibes are also a little bit easier to achieve when you are seeing that there are better results ahead based on what the underlying stuff is telling you. And frustration still exists when things aren't going well, but they need to coexist. And when you have good clubhouse culture, which is something that, from what we've heard, was kind of lost last year on this team, then it does get a bit easier to weather the bad times.
Yeah. Even then, like, I would like some people to speak about the specifics of what has changed. Because even then, it's like this magical...
We're probably not going to hear it.
Yeah, right? And it's this magical... And if they lose 8 in a row, then we're going to hear the same stuff about as last year. So, yeah, it's interesting how these things work coming out of a series with the Athletics versus coming out of a series with the Rays, you know?
Yeah, no, listen, and again, that series against the Rays, what positives can you take out of that, right?
The clubhouse culture wasn't good at Steinbrenner Field, but it was good at Rogers Center. The chairs, the changing the order everyone sits in really did have... you get the Steinbrenner and everyone's just kind of on folding chairs in right field, you know?
Yeah, maybe that is part of it. No, listen, the mental part of the game, any player will tell you, it's a real thing. And I am sure that with the gap being existing between underlying numbers, expected numbers, and what the Blue Jays were actually performing to early in the season, I'm sure it didn't help, right? But those are the moments that you kind of need to come together. And when John Schneider talks about guys settling into their routines, guys getting into a rhythm and tweaking in between, but you know, you kind of have a foundation. Maybe they needed a bit of time earlier on this year, considering that they changed the entire hitting coaching staff to sort of get settled. And now here they are. And maybe, just maybe, I don't want to make any overarching statements here, but maybe what we saw in this series is a bit closer to this team's identity on offense than what we saw in April.
And you hope so, because, you know, again, I mentioned it wasn't just this week. It was the month of May where there a lot of their metrics kind of came around, and there was the bad week, but a month is a very long time. If we look at the whole month, they were among the league leaders in a few categories. This was obviously a particularly standout five-game stretch. We mentioned they hadn't won. They haven't won more than five in a row in a little bit here. They mopped the A's, and 1.063 OPS over those last five games with 12 home runs. That is their best five-game stretch by OPS since September of 2021, when they were making a late push for the wild card spot. And yeah, for the month of May, leading the league or close to the lead league in a lot of categories. We talked about, you know, the amount of hard outs they were hitting into. Mm-hmm. You don't really want to lead the league in that, but it is at least predictive of better future outcomes. So the month of May ends up pretty good. They are three games better in the standings right now than they were on June 2nd this time last year. So obviously still not where they want to be. They're half a game out of a wild card spot. But if we are comparing to prior years, and especially when you compare the state of the AL East to prior years, coming off just a so-so weekend for the Yankees. They might have lost Jason Dominguez last night to a thumb thing, stealing a base too.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so we'll see where that one lands. But it's wide open, and the Blue Jays have put themselves in a better position than they were at this time last year. Let's get into some of the specifics.
Sure.
And it is also, by the way, I don't know if you didn't look at the top of the doc today or whatever. We got right into the game stuff. I can't believe you didn't make a comment about the top of the doc.
Oh, yeah. Care to explain?
Yeah. So we have a couple of notes off the top. Well, not off the top anymore. First of all, happy Pride Month.
Happy
the Blue
Pride
Jays
Month.
Will have Pride Night on Friday, June 20th. Down at the ballpark. We hope we'll get more details on that prior to like the day of. As in past years, you get a little carry bag this time. So that's fun. You had a very funny Instagram post about Prime of you just sitting at your desk at the ballpark yesterday.
Yeah, by myself.
Yes.
I had a friend text me and say, why is no one else sitting in your row? Did they just rope it off for you for Prime?
Yes.
You just get a whole row for yourself.
Yes.
This is reparations for you.
Yes. I thought it was more a nod at like they put the LGBTQ plus representation all in one section.
Yeah.
And you were the only one there in the media room. I don't know if that's true, by the way.
We can't know, but
yes.
You know, that's kind of where we are. No, it was, that row is mostly just me and Keegan. Richard Griffin will pop in every once in a while, but he's a manager now, you know, he's a skipper, so he's doing his own thing.
Yes.
Yeah, Keegan and I have successfully scared everyone else off, which I'm proud of, honestly.
There you go. There you go. I sit in the never-ending row of Sportsnet seats. By the way, Keegan's coming on the show today.
Oh,
Carlos,
yeah.
Pena is going to come on the show as well around 10:35. We'll talk to him, some science of hitting stuff, some mentality in the batter's box stuff as well. And then Keegan will join us for the whole second hour to talk about this, his book, The Franchise, which is out tomorrow. It's out pretty much ever. I've seen it at multiple stores now, and I got my copy like a month ago, just ordering it from a local bookstore. So it's out, but officially it's out tomorrow.
Yeah, it's really just an excuse to party and have some drinks.
Yes. Well, we're not doing that on the show
on Thursday
because it's 11 a.m. when Keegan comes on.
Right.
But yes, we'll do that Thursday at the official book launch. You guys will do that again a little later. We'll give you some details on the book signings and the book events that you and Keegan are doing. The other note that I have in there is today is Lou Gehrig's day.
Yeah.
So tomorrow at the ballpark, you'll see a lot of purple. That is the Blue Jays don't play today. So in honor of ALS and ALS Canada, the Blue Jays will have some things going on at the ballpark. You would have seen the number 4 patch on the Yankees and Dodgers jerseys last night. If you were watching Sunday Night Baseball, you'll see some guys with wristbands that say 4 ALS. You will hear people talk about our friend Sarah Langs from MLB.com, who has been battling ALS. This is actually a Sarah Langs T-shirt that says baseball is the best and ALS down. You can't really see because the microphone's in the way. There you go for the small percentage of the audience on TV. So that is also going down. If you see a lot of purple at the ballpark tomorrow, that is why. You can find out more by Googling NALS or ALS Canada. And yeah, shout out to our pal Sarah Langs. And the other word that was at the top of the top was just mop.
Mop.
What do you think of that? So that is a, we've had Jake Mintz and Jordan Schusterman of Cespedes Family Barbecue on in the past. That is their thing. A sweep is a 3-game set. A mopping is a 4-game set. You like it? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
I hate it.
Okay.
I'm sorry to the guys. They're so nice and they're really fun and a lot of good stuff there. I don't like it at all. I tend to be very traditional, which is funny. Again, happy pride. but when it comes to that stuff, I tend to be very traditional. I don't like it. I take it you do, considering it was all over
our document.
I think
it's funny. Yeah, all over. It was in one spot.
Yeah. It just, you know.
Yeah.
It was annoying because I don't like it very much.
Yeah, it's a super sweep. Whatever. I don't know what to call it. There needs to be a line of differentiation between a 2-game sweep, a 3-game sweep, and a 4-game sweep.
You can just say that.
Yeah. Well, it's not my thing. Okay, so let's get into the specifics. So the Jays win 11-7 on Friday. A lot of early offense. It kind of carries a rough Chris Bassitt outing. He was very hard on himself after the game, probably needlessly so, given how often over the last couple of years he has helped carry the Blue Jays and keep them in games where the bats weren't there.
Yep.
You were owed one, Chris Bassitt. Ernie Clement and Addison Barger hit homers in that one, including a no-look home run from Addison Barger where his helmet fell over his eyes. Saturday, the Blue Jays stake the A's 3 runs in the first inning as part of a bullpen day. Jeff Hoffman is iffy late in the game, and yet still they win 8-7. Addison Barger homers again, Bo Bichette homers, George Springer homers twice. Sunday rolls around. They're down into the 8th, 4-2. It looks like we're going to have a normal close game. Boom. 6-run inning. Addison Barger homers again. 3 days in a row. So they put up 11-8-8 over the course of the weekend. Obviously a big number on Thursday as well. I guess the way I laid that out, there's not really a place to go other than Addison Barger. Homered in 3 consecutive games. He's up to an 8.17 OPS on the season, which is about 30% better than league average. Yeah, we knew the batted ball stuff was all there, and you expect it to come around at some point.
Yeah.
This was a little on the nose of just everything's going to leave the park now.
Just incredible stuff. And the thing that I keep coming back to is that it's more than just raw power, Blake. We're seeing a guy mature before our very eyes. Because when he got here, and even dating back to last season, we could all see the tools, we could all see the strength and the arm and all of that. But putting it all together is something else entirely. And now we're starting to see the maturity. We're starting to see the baseball IQ grow. And he is seeing more pitches. He is taking more pitches. When he swings, it's still, and especially when he swings and misses, it is still a sight to behold. But listen, he's putting it all together. He's doing it. He's playing incredibly at third base. Well, incredibly might be a little bit strong.
I mean, the metrics like him a lot. The arm makes up for a lot.
You know what? That's good. And it's been solid. Let's put it like that. We'll see what happens now with Andrés Giménez coming back, and we can get into that a little bit later. But we're kind of seeing it all from Addison Barger. He is cutting down his swing a little bit when he needs to just make contact. He is seeing more pitches, and even Kevin Gausman mentioned it yesterday, right? At bats in which he would strike out a few weeks ago, now we're seeing him foul some pitches off and stay alive and take his walks when they're there. So I think that's the most important thing. The home runs are cool, and they're always going to be part of his game, but I don't know. It's just, it's a different player than the one we saw last year, right?
Yeah, and it's, you know, we can capture some of that too. You know, his chase rate is slightly better than league average. His whiff rate is right around league average. So even with a big, powerful swing, those are the type of guys that you tend to see higher strikeout rates, higher swing and miss rates, and you accept it.
Yeah.
If you're gonna hit the ball that hard, if you're Giancarlo Stanton, if you're O'Neal Cruz, you're going to take some swing and miss, and that's fine because it is with the purpose of getting into those big swings. But Addison Barger so far has done a good job limiting that. We'll see that continue, I think. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it will continue at like an 8.17 OPS. Like, I feel a little justified that we kind of spent like 2 weeks whining on the air that Addison Barger wasn't getting consistent enough playing time for this stuff to turn around. And we were pretty right.
Yeah, now he's getting consistent playing time and the stuff is turning around. It is almost as if you should give the guys you call up a chance to show what they can do.
At least the ones that have a ceiling, right? Yes. Like if you're calling up a guy to be Bradley Zimmer 3.0 or whatever, yeah. Sure, I don't care. You're like if they weren't playing Nathan Lucas every day, and Nathan Lucas has been very solid against righties and he's going to be in the lion's share of the reps in center field now with Dalton Varsho down. But as an example, like a 30-year-old who's been in AAA for a couple years, if he came up and wasn't playing every day, whatever. Yeah. You call up Addison Barger, who's tools out the wazoo, and have him sit on the bench, that's when it gets a little tougher. There's going to be playing time to go around with Varsho and Santander down, even with Andrés Giménez back, like you said. We'll get to that in a minute here. George Springer also hit 3 home runs over the course of this series. He had been in that kind of 17-game rut where his OPS had dipped below 500 during that stretch. He has turned it around. He's taking a lot of walks as well. However,
yes,
bouncing up and down on third base,
yes.
Going first to third on Alejandro Kirk double. He initially gets called safe and then upon review is called out because he was feeling out his ankle by bouncing up and down on the base. It was a silly one all around.
It was. And it kind of, you know, if you're watching from the press box, you can really see that play. And right away, I turned to Keegan and I said, they got him. But it looked to us like he was just celebrating, right? Looking into the dugout and maybe he was testing out his ankle. Still, you need to be way, way more aware of the situation of where the game is. You're finally getting to a starting pitcher. And if you want to talk about momentum, that could have been a self-inflicted momentum killer because that ended the inning when the Blue Jays were finally getting something done.
Thankfully, the run came in before he got tagged out because that would have been a real disaster.
That would have been a disaster. And it happened recently. I mentioned this in the post-game show yesterday too, but it happened in the ACAA softball tournament in which a player hit a double and she was celebrating by jumping up and down on second base and got tagged in the butt, tagged out. That's it. And they lost that game by one run. And I could only, you know, imagine if that had been the case. I'm sure that, you know, everyone was happy in that clubhouse yesterday. George Springer must have been extremely relieved. You don't expect that from him. He's a veteran guy. I interviewed him recently for a feature, Blake, in which I kind of asked him about playing with joy, right? He and Vladdy are always dancing around or and talking to someone and doing something funny or whatever. You see it in the dugout. You see it in the clubhouse, pregame, whatever it may be. And he said, yeah, this to me is everything. It's the way that I have done it and that I found success in my career. And that's all great. He was the one who said, there's a big difference between playing with joy and, his words, screwing around. Well, we saw the other side of that yesterday.
Yeah, thankfully, the explanation after the game was he had tweaked his ankle a little bit and was feeling it out. But yeah, that's it's a silly one all around. It also, yeah, you mentioned it ended the inning. We would have had 2 runners in scoring position for Addison Barger, which is a pretty nice spot to be in the last week or so. Mm-hmm. It's a tough one. It's one of those ones where, like, in the moment, it feels like a Bush League thing to run and put the tag on someone who's, like, clearly safe at the base. It's like something I would do with my little brothers playing pickle in the backyard.
Right.
Like, oh, you're off the base. I got you. But this is the major leagues. If you could take a free out and save your pitcher, you absolutely take it. George Springer, great weekend otherwise. Every Blue Jay had a great weekend, basically, other than the guys who went on the IL. Almost literally. So of all the Blue Jays who played, everyone had good numbers except for Dalton Varsho and Anthony Santander, who both hit the IL, and then Michael Stefanik and Ali Sanchez, who are about to be optioned down, I think. All of those guys had good numbers over the 5-game winning streak. Springer, Guerrero, Clement, Bichette, Barger, and Kirk all had OPS pluses of 200 or higher during this 5-game stretch.
Wow.
So double the league average. This is what it looks like. This is not what it's going to look like for the next 100 games, but this is what it looks like when you get on a heater offensively. The numbers get silly in a hurry. What do you want to do? You want to do the injury fallout, or do you want to touch on the pitching side from this weekend? We got 5 minutes before we get the call.
I think we need to talk about the injuries. We can talk about pitching with Keegan when he's here. But
yeah, the only real note on the pitching side is Bass was too hard on himself. Yariel rocks. There, we did the pitching side. Done.
Check.
Yeah. So injury fallout. So, by the way, Eric Swanson is back.
Got the win yesterday.
Yes, giving up that run in the eighth almost ended up being very, very big and a very auspicious return. Anyway, Anthony Santander has hit the IL with that shoulder thing that had been bothering him for a little while. He went for an MRI. We didn't get update on the results. We'll probably get that tomorrow pregame. Possible he needs a cortisone shot. We'll see. Dalton Varsho came up, turning second, trying to turn a double into a triple, grabbed at his hamstring, hopped to third base, was tagged out. He has a grade one hamstring strain. That is week to week. The corresponding moves, Alan Roden came up for Anthony Santander, and then David Schneider, yeah, fresh off the show, comes up. So we are anticipating Andrés Giménez and Tyler Heineman returning Tuesday. David Schneider and Alan Roden are up. Dalton Varsho and Anthony Santander have hit the IL. Michael Stefanik and Ali Sanchez are the logical names to go back down. Yeah. And I say Stefanik over David Schneider because with all of these injuries, you need a little more offensive pop, and you're going to start that guy a little bit more. Whereas Stefanik is the type of guy I should have used him as an example, not Nathan Lucas, as a guy that if he wasn't getting playing time in the 13th roster spot, you're fine. There is going to be a lot of playing time to go around, and there's a bit of a crunch on the infield, but in the outfield, it's going to be, it's going to rotate around. It's going to be based on platoons and things like that. Safe to say Giménez is going to play a fair amount at second base. Mm-hmm. Ernie Clement's strong play has maybe eaten into that a little bit. Ernie Clement can also play at third base, which you don't want to eat into Addison Barger's playing time, but Addison Barger can also play right field, where there's now a hole because two outfielders are on the IL, and George Springer can have more DH days because Santander's not there. Of all the ways this could shake out, the Lucas Straw platoon in center, Class A Roden and Schneider all fitting in somewhere, what is the thing that you are most concerned about, or the person whose playing time you most have eyes on here? There are a lot of ways it could shake out. What's the most important thing to shake out of this for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Frankly, you know, entering the series or whatever, we kind of knew that Andrés Giménez was going to be back, and that the plan would be to have him play second base every day. That was kind of a given. And then Ernie Clement caught fire, and now I don't know anymore. Because if the goal is to continue to put forward your best offensive lineup, that may not be Andrés Giménez every day. And so how do you reconcile that? And listen, this was a big trade, right? The Blue Jays went for it. This is a big contract that he signed to. He is a defensive upgrade, even though Ernie Clement has been great.
Ernie Clement near the league lead in outs above average among all American League fielders. And he's second in wins above replacement among AL third basemen, too.
So, you know, do you want to cut that guy's playing time all that much? I understand that there were a lot of lefties on the docket here, and that is why... that is a big part of why we saw just the numbers kind of explode for Clement.
He still only has a 536 OPS against righties this year, and historically has hit lefties better. So I think you can make the easy case that Giménez will take some of Ernie Clement's starts against right-handed pitching. But you don't want Ernie Clement to go back to the playing time he was at before, which is, who knows, maybe it ends up good. You can protect Giménez from some tougher lefties. Maybe he doesn't play against Christopher Sanchez on Wednesday in the second game of that series. They are only scheduled to face one left-handed starter this week. Mm-hmm. So it'd be five righties to one lefty. So Ernie Clement is probably the guy who sees his playing time hit a little bit.
Right?
But the ability to move Addison Barger to right field is at least helpful.
So is that what you would...
I mean, not on a full-time basis, but I think, like, if we look at the next six games, you can find four starts for Ernie Clement between the start against Christopher Sanchez, where he can play second base, and then moving Addison Barger to a corner outfield against those righties, where David Schneider's probably not starting against a righty. It doesn't look like they've wanted to start Jonathan Clase every day against righties. You have some, you know, options there. I guess they want Roden in there against righties, but that's probably a left field thing. I think you could still find four starts for Ernie Clement over the course of six games, even with only one lefty in there.
So we got a few calls and texts yesterday in the postgame show from people who were very against Addison Barger seeing any time in right field.
I mean, it's going to be that, or he's sitting on the bench.
Or it's just a platoon situation with Ernie Clement.
So what do you, if you want his bat in there every day and like, You have to think ahead as well to things like the trade deadline and future years, where if he can show that he's capable in either of those spots, that opens up your options, right? Like, let's play out the scenario where they didn't sign Anthony Santander or he's out for the season or something like that. The ability to go out and you can address the offense at third base or a corner outfield or DH is a lot easier to resolve than you have to address this at this one position.
Right.
The positional flexibility is good. And I think like Barger's not as good in right field as he is at third base, I don't think. But the arm makes up for a lot there too. So I get people not, you know, he's in a groove. You don't want to disrupt it. You don't want to change too much. But the most important thing is keeping the bat in there. And that's going to mean a couple of starts in right field, unless you just want to ice Ernie Clement, which I don't think they're going to do.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, maybe when this team is in full force and or whatever, we're going to have a different conversation. And then it does look like a bit more of a platoon situation. But for right now, with the way that things are going, you kind of need those two guys in there as much as you possibly can. And you have to get creative and you have to get disruptive in order to make that happen. It kind of comes with the territory, and I would still argue that it's a great problem to have even after two very big injury developments for this team in Dalton Varsho and Anthony Santander.
Yeah, it's better to have more players playing well and more good players. Yeah. And I know people were down on Andrés Giménez before the injury. I still think he probably ends up being like about an average bat, and then the defense at second base is what it is. And yeah, Ernie Clement's been good defensively at second base, but he's also good at defensively at third base. And you know, this is the benefit of having guys who are positionally flexible. Not to go all Tampa Bay Rays brain on it, where where actually being bad at every position is better than being good at any one position.
Yeah.
So sorry, Jose Caballero. But like, this is part of why, especially when guys get to AAA, why David Schneider is suddenly taking reps at third base, even though he's better at second base and left field. Why Addison Barger started at shortstop for the Bisons earlier this year. This is why you do that stuff, so that, you know, it's rarely going to be as clean as third baseman is hurt. You have a third baseman ready to go at AAA who you're comfortable playing every day. This sort of flexibility is, I mean, it's why you build a roster this way, and it's why you treat AAA as much as a finishing school to get guys ready for different options in the majors.
Yep.
As anything. Like, yeah, obviously if Arjun Namala is bouncing around the diamond right now, I'm not cool with that. I would like to know if he's going to be able to stick at shortstop and get 100%. The reps every day at shortstop. But he's a 19-year-old at high A. If he is suddenly a 24-year-old at AAA and you're iffy on the shortstop defense and you have Bo Bichette, then let's see him at second. Let's see him at third. Let's see him in center field, whatever. You know, that's why you do this stuff. And then you have a million outfielders for three starting spots every day. One of the ways to open this up, honestly, too, is George Springer just sees more DH days during this stretch.
It looks like it'll be the case.
Yeah,
right?
Especially if the ankle's bothering him a little bit. You could have Vladimir Guerrero Jr. DH and Ernie Clement start at first base, which is always a funny thing when the guy who has out of this world defensive numbers at third and second is playing first base.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Good for him.
It's that utility gold glove locked up now.
100%. And he is athletic and smart enough to play all of these positions well. He did make one pretty weird throw to second yesterday, which you can excuse it for sure. But, you know, it's clear that that's not where he belongs, if you want to be very, very honest about it. But yeah, he does continue to impress with his ability to kind of do everything around the diamond well, or well enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and first base is a odd spot to struggle at, but the diamond is reversed on you. You're not a huge guy for the stretch and things like that. I can look past that one. I would guess we see Ernie at first probably once this week, though, just as a matter of rotating everyone around and getting everyone the reps. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk nerdy about some hitting. Let's talk some Detroit Tigers with Carlos Pena of MLB Network, of the Tigers broadcast as well. He knows Vlad, and Vlad swing really well, so we'll get into Vlad's stuff as well. And also, Spencer Torkelson hit another one on the weekend. The Royals and Tigers played a pair of 1-0 games, but Friday was a bit of a everyone hits on the Tigers day. Riley Green hit one as well. He's pretty hot right now. So let's take a break. Let's talk to Carlos Pena about it. That's next as Jay's Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreitz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Blue Jays win 4 in a row against the Athletics. They also won a game before that, so they are on a 5-game winning streak. It's a little unfamiliar.
That is a little unfamiliar. You know what? I will say this, and I don't want to toot my own horn, but sometimes you kind of have to. On Thursday, I actually called the sweep Blake, and no one believed me. In fact, Maxine said, stop putting so much pressure on the players. Just let them go play. But I did say, listen, I think that this is going to, it's looking like this is going to happen. The bats kind of got going and it looked for real. And so, listen, I'm not saying that I'm going to bring it up for the rest of the season, but I probably am going to bring it up for
well,
the rest of
the you should do it for the Philly series then too, because if
I'm
you
not
have
gonna call a sweep
you,
there.
If Absolutely you have that not. Kind of power. The Philly series, by the way, it is lined up to be Bowden Francis, Jose Berríos, and Chris Bassett against Zach Wheeler, Christopher Sanchez, and Mick Abel. The Blue Jays are back to within half a game of a playoff spot, which is, you know, not where the ultimate goal is, but certainly better than where things looked a second ago. They're 5.5 back of the Yankees, and then way, 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 way ahead at the top of the American League are the Detroit Tigers. Our next guest talks about those Detroit Tigers regularly. He's also a contributor on MLB Network, a 3-time Emmy Award winner, and a former All-Star. It's Carlos Pena. Carlos, good morning, man. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me, guys. Like, it's 4-time Emmy Award
four?
Winner.
Okay, yeah, you know, I didn't realize you won a four. I was reading, I went back and I watched one of your Sloan Analytics Conference presentations from the other year, and you were introduced as a 3-time Emmy Award winner there. So I guess the fourth is more recent. I apologize, and congratulations on number four.
You call yourself a numbers guy, Blake. Carlos, thank you for doing this.
I'm just joking, Blake. But it is true, though.
Yeah, hey, look, man, if I had four Emmys, I'd let people know, too. I'd probably carry them with me all the time and just have them sitting out on the desk.
That's what I do, actually.
Yeah, great. Carlos, Tigers take 2 of 3 against the Royals this weekend. A couple of 1-0 games, which were tight and a lot of fun. And Tarek Skubal spun another gem. 7 shutouts, 7 strikeouts. There's not a ton new to say, I guess, about just how good Skubal is, but you're so good at analyzing what hitters look like in the box. What are you seeing from guys when they're trying to face Tarek Skubal right now?
They're in between. And what I mean by that is this. They try to cover the fastball, and at the same time, they're worried about the changeup. And that is impossible to do. And unfortunately, as hitters, we are not good gamblers. You know, we really are not. So when you have to be all in on something. If you're in between, if you are hunting a fastball, but then you are at the same time protecting for a changeup, then that means you're not all in on the fastball. So when Skubal throws the fastball, nice swing, but slightly late. Nice swing, but you fouled it off. You know, it's like, it's incredible how we do that. I think it's just part of human nature. It's almost as if we do not want to give up anything. And in order for you to hit a guy like Skubal, you have to be able to give up something instead of trying to mitigate risk. The way you mitigate risk is by actually taking it. As you can see, it's totally backwards and counterintuitive, but that is all you can do against Skubal. And I'll say against really good pitchers. When we go to the plate and try to cover the entire strike zone and cover all possibilities, then we really put ourselves in a very dire situation. So that's why you see hitters not have success against Skubal.
Carlos, you mentioned, you know, other great pitchers as well. And this obviously doesn't come out of nowhere, right? Tarek Skubal has sort of established his dominance there, and he continues to, and that is kind of maybe, you know, getting in the head of some hitters here, and they're trying to cover all of it, like you said. But, you know, what have you seen from Skubal that has sort of allowed him to maintain this dominance even after the Cy Young season? It does seem like he's still finding new gears here. Just, you know, taking that closer look at him, how does he look to you on the mound?
Yeah, great question, Julia, because I think sometimes we talk about, like, wow, this guy throws first pitch strikes, right? He's so good. He's got so much control, right? However, it's not just about throwing strikes. It's about locating the fastball in the strike zone or even out of the strike zone. So there's two different, you know, there's a distinction we have to make between having command and control. Let's say control is more of a general term where you could be like, hey, throw strikes. Yeah, but I don't care too much about just throwing strikes. You know, that's important. But if you're going to be absolutely elite to the level that Skubal is at, then you have to have command. And he commands the fastball in the uppermost and innermost part of the strike zone and even beyond the strike zone. So he throws chase pitches above the strike zone on purpose and actually hits the spot he's going to. You know, that's another thing that a lot of people will say, oh, he's missing his spots when pitchers are in trouble. But what really guarantees you that that was the right spot to go to in the first place? I mean, I've seen pitches, you know, I've seen catchers set up outside and the pitcher throws the ball and it's absolutely perfect, exactly where the catcher wanted it, and the ball gets crushed. Oh, I got that, you know, over the fence. And now we're like, why don't we say there, oh, he missed his spot. No, he didn't. He didn't miss the spot. He went right to the spot he wanted to. It was just the wrong spot. So, Julia, going back to Scooble throws it in the right spot. He commands it. You know what that right spot is? That dominance of the upper and, you know, up and in part of the strike zone to hitters. That really hijacks, and I'm going to get a little bit technical here, but that really hijacks the amygdala to a hitter. When you're throwing 9,900 miles per hour in that uppermost, innermost quadrant, and you do it at will, whenever he wants to, it hijacks the amygdala, which triggers immediately the fight or flight response on a human. Because we're all human at the end of the day, even though we're elite athletes, right? And all of a sudden, when you throw that changeup and it looks like the fastball that just scared you, you're going to swing over it. So that's what I'm saying. It's like it's a perfect combination, and he does this at will. So you're right, Julia. There is a method to the madness. This is not just by chance. This is designed to work the way it works.
It's a fight, flight, or a freeze, right?
Yeah.
As he gets those backwards K's as well. Yeah, it's been really good to... But obviously, you know, the offense, I know that a couple of one-run games here, but the offense has kind of been rolling too. Blake, you highlighted Spencer Torkelson.
Yeah, Spencer Torkelson hit his 14th home run on Friday. And Carlos, I know you had a really good breakdown on him, so apologies for asking you about it again. But what have you seen from Torkelson this year, not just in terms of the power, because we saw 31 home runs from him in 2023, but he wasn't a full hitter. He wasn't able to stick necessarily. What has changed for him from a consistency aspect so far this year?
Yeah, there's two parts to the adjustments that he has made. And I'm going to start with the physical adjustments that he's made. When we look at his body, like just look at his stance, like it's amazing how obvious the changes have been as far as like the way he is loading his backside, his front side. Now he almost gets on his toe on his front foot. So all of his weight, it's getting back there. And methods are many and principles are few, but there is a method that you've seen, you know, Aaron Judge use. You've seen also Kerry Carpenter use, which is they load the backside and they have no weight. They're almost hitting on one leg. They have no weight in the front leg and they're very short with their movements, you know. Well, Torkelson did, you know, made that adjustment. He made some changes there as far as physically and biomechanically going to that method. And it's worked well for him. It's not like I recommend this to all the players. This is something that's worked well for him. And this is very important to say because a lot of kids out there are like, oh, I'm going to hit like Aaron Judge or I'm going to hit like Torkelson. I'm like, no, wait. You have to work with what you have. But most importantly, after you make those physical changes, I'll tell you what, guys, the way he has approached pitchers and the way he has gone. Remember I told you earlier that Scooble tries to get hitters in between? Torque has not fallen for that trick. He maybe in the past tried to cover the entire strike zone, and that's why you saw a lot of inconsistencies. Early on here, I've seen him hunt pitches, stay with a plan, have a strategy, right? And that has really translated into consistent contact the other way, right center field, off speed pitches. He's driving with power the opposite way as well. And then if something is of, you know, he likes it, right? And it's right middle in part of the strike zone, he pulls it. Because you've seen, if you see his home run spray chart, you've seen a few home runs right center field. And of course, most of his homers are going to be pull side, but his mentality is, I'm looking for something elevated, up in the zone. Sometimes I'm going to sit on off speed. So do you see that it's not just about, hey, I just made some physical changes? Mm-hmm. No, I also have a very specific plan for Berríos. I have a specific plan, you know, for if he were to play Scoobal, even though, you know, he's so happy he doesn't have to. There's a specific plan for Scoobal. I mean, we saw him face Lugo and that incredible outing that he just had. And he had some great at-bats against him with a very specific plan. Now, the very next day, he may vary his plan. He should. It's a different pitcher. So it's almost like he caters each pitcher on the mound. That's what's going to give you success.
That's brilliant. You know, Carlos, you mentioned kids these days are saying, I'm going to hit like Aaron Judge. I'm going to hit like Spencer Torkelson. Well, in Toronto or in Canada, kids are saying, I'm going to hit like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And who's been very, very good for the Blue Jays this year, 32-game on base streak right now. And we're seeing him take his walks. We're seeing him be extremely patient in his approach, not really chasing power. I know that you've spoken to him at length about this and about his swing, about his offensive production. What are you seeing from him in this 32-game stretch or throughout the season?
Yeah, I'm a big fan, of course. You know, I've seen him grow. I've seen him develop throughout the years. I've seen him go through some quote-unquote struggles, and the reason why I say quote-unquote is because, you know, Vlad's struggles are other players' dream season. You know what I mean? It's like we start criticizing him, you know, but he's hitting 280. You know, we're like all panicking, you know, or 270. We're like, what? What's going on? He's in a slump. I'm like, no, let's look at the process. Let's be process-oriented, and that's what you're alluding to, Julie. I mean, the way that he's been taking his walks, not chasing out of the strike zone, not chasing power. That is very key, because power is almost as if the way I like to think about power, it's just a consequence of or a product of a good approach to the plate. So it happens without you chasing it. It happens by just you having executing your process. And I just talked to you about what Torkelson is doing. Well, guess what? Same applies to Vlad Guerrero Jr. when he goes up to the plate. Is having that plan and then going out there and executing it. And it should vary from pitcher to pitcher. And then you stick to it. And there's a reason why you have that type of plan. It also does this. So key important fact here is that when we're thinking about what pitch to hunt, right, what pitch I want to hit, it also allows you to lay off and not swing at tricky pitches, right? Because that's what the pitchers try to do to us. It's like a magician with a sleight of hand. If they get us to look in the wrong direction, then they're going to trick us. They're going to trick us. And then we're going to be like, oh, what just happened? I'm walking back to the dugout. You got tricked. Well, when you eliminate those, now you're taking your walks. So for Vlad, maybe I'm looking up for something elevated. I'm going to get on the highest speed and I'm going to make sure I cover it. And now anything low, it's just not going to look good to me. So you've seen him just lay off these like sliders low and away. He doesn't even offer them. It's like, well, that's not even close to where I'm looking. So when they throw that slider, it's an easy take, you know, and then they'll throw him an inside fastball and he crushes it. And you're like, how did he get to that? Well, maybe he is ready for that. And he is anticipating that. Do you see how there's strategy behind everything? So what I've seen from him is that other level of execution, and that's part of maturity. Look, when he first got to the league, the thought was, give me the bat. You know, it doesn't matter what you throw, I'm just going to hit it. You know, and great, he's got that type of talent. However, why not funnel all that ability and really harness it, right, and really zero in on the zone? Now you become, you know, now you get to a different level. I mean, when you think about 32 straight games getting on base. I mean, like, we just throwing it out there. Like, oh, 32 straight games. No. Think about that. Count to 30. See how long it'll take you. It'll take you at least 30 seconds. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a long time. And I think we kind of wave at it and almost we don't understand how impressive that is. In this league, you know, and we're kind of like, oh, it's just like a sneeze for Vlad. No, that's pretty impressive, and it shows that he's been really, really disciplined at the plate.
Yeah, the Blue Jays have played 59 games this season, and he's been on base for the past 32. It's been really amazing to see.
Carlos, before we let you go here, that's a lot of great information. I could pick your brain about the AI and machine learning side of stuff that you've been studying as well. But there was also some news last week that you're going to be a manager down in Lidom now with Leones de Escogido. How are you feeling about that? And congratulations.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm gonna be in the front office, so I'm going to be the general manager of Leones Escogido. I actually am the general manager of Leones Escogido. Our manager is Alex Cintron, Blake, which I'm pretty sure you're familiar with him, former player as well, and now he's a coach for the Houston Astros. You know what? This is a new stage in my career, and this is something that, as you know, you alluded to the fact that, all my studies, with artificial intelligence and how do I apply artificial intelligence in sports. And I'm not talking Terminator here. we're not going to have robot hitters and none of that. But the idea is this. I've always been a learner. So I've always wanted to gain, the new perspectives, new information. And I'm trying to be innovative. I'm trying to be in the vanguard, right? Ahead of everything, leading edge as far as, our sport is concerned. And here comes an opportunity for me to apply some of the concepts that I've been learning, that I've been formulating, all these ideas, to be able to implement them. It's not that easy. Obviously, numbers are numbers, formulas are formulas, coding, it's coding and all of that. However, when you go in to talk to athletes, athletes are human. So sometimes all of these formulas are really cool to look at, but what can you actually use? What can be applicable? All that stuff is so intriguing to me and so interesting. Like how can I help a Vlad Guerrero Jr. get to another level? How could I help a Torkelson get to another level? Well, at this point, when this opportunity came, man, I jumped on it just because it provides that opportunity to come forth and really put all that stuff to practice. And, man, we have some really good players, and I'm really looking forward to going out there and putting it all together and contributing. I mean, these guys are the champions of the Winter League and the champions of the Caribbean Series. So it's not like the bar is set really high, guys.
That's great, man. Truly. I'm looking forward to that. That's always a lot of fun for us to check out when the MLB season rolls to a close. Carlos, congratulations again, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Blake, Julia, always a pleasure, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Thanks, Carlos. Absolutely. Carlos Pena, MLB Network, Tigers broadcast with Bally Sports Detroit, Placada Nation, the podcast on Espanol. You would understand it. I got to hit the translate
really
button on all the
stuff.
Instagram. Yeah, really, really good stuff. And 4 Emmy Awards, not 3, Blake.
I will say that the manager thing was my bad. I did write it down wrong in our doc.
Oh,
and
that's fine.
I do apologize.
Yes, Albert Pujols was the manager when they won the championship last year. This is a legacy franchise and a lot
really,
of fun players
really
down there.
A ton of major leaguers too.
Yes, and some connection to the Toronto Raptors, but that's a whole different segment as well. Right now, we're going to take a break, and we're going to get to the signature segment, I guess, of the week. Keegan's joining us. He's waiting outside the door, banging and looking in the window funny right now. We're going to have Keegan Matheson on for the second hour in studio with us. We'll talk about the current Blue Jays. We'll get a little bit more into what happened on the weekend and how these injuries are going to shake out. But most importantly, we're going to talk about Keegan's new book, The Franchise, A Curated History of the Toronto Blue Jays, which is out tomorrow, but it's out most places now, so you can check that out. Let's take a break. Keegan Matheson joins us in studio on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. And if you are watching on television instead of listening on podcast or terrestrial radio, you will see a third person on the screen with us. It's Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com, and author of The Franchise, A Curated History of the Toronto Blue Jays, which is out tomorrow, but really out everywhere now. Keegan, how you doing, buddy?
Very well. I'm happy to be here. This is a little cooler than my normal radio setup. Sitting at home, dressed not like this.
Yes.
So I'm real happy to be here.
Yeah, I was expecting you to do what I actually do some days, because you'll notice, and you didn't know this coming in, I don't think, but they can't see below your waist.
Yeah.
And I don't dress super nice for the show anyway, but the collar shirt with basketball shorts on underneath is a move I've pulled off before, and I borderline expected it from you here.
When you open up the very handsome picture on the back cover of that, me in a suit jacket, it's gym shorts on the bottom. Absolutely. But I had to class up this joint a little bit. We all can't look like we're going to a rock and roll music concert here. So
I mean, my shirt is in support of ALS and our pal Sarah Lang. Sorry for
everyone's looking good.
Also, rock and roll music.
You know what? It's been a tough week for me. I wore a suit jacket to the ballpark the other day, and no one reacted well to it.
Yeah.
Players, coaches, media. I told John Schneider that I just went into a Target and held up a picture of him like announcing a 3-year deal for a mid-range free agent and said, give me this. But it's been a little out of the ordinary this week.
You've succeeded. I did want to ask you first, I guess, start with how has this time been for you? I know how much you love talking about yourself.
Yeah.
How is the tour going for you?
It's going well. I'm getting better at it. I'm not good at it yet. It's awkward because a lot of it centers me, right, which is not how this job's supposed to work. And it's been a lesson in me to kind of have two different sides to my brain, like one for my night-to-night job covering the Jays and one for this, which I have to talk about myself a bit more. Julia's heard me rant so many times of, you know, if somebody mentions or references themselves in a story and I just start cursing and ranting. So this has been a shift. But it's been very good, and I'm trying to let myself enjoy it, you know? And, like, this especially, like, this is a really happy moment for me. You know, I'm trying to do a better job of recognizing when I'm in a good moment at the time instead of 2 years later and saying, oh. But sitting here talking about this with two friends who I care about, this is special for me. So these are good days.
By the way, you mentioned the tour, Julia. Thursday is the official launch party.
It's had a great grill. What's June the name 5th? Of that grill?
Sportsnet wow. Grill. It is, so after Jays Phillies, it's a 3:07 start as a work from dome day. Once you are done working and doming, you make your way over to the Sportsnet Grill, and you'll be there chatting, I assume signing some books.
Yeah.
And this being at a Sportsnet / Marriott property, I know you don't like to talk about yourself that much, but this seems, that seems a little on the nose.
But I love talking about Marriott points. In fact, a lot of people in my life would prefer I stop talking about Marriott points, but those are my sports. Those are what I care most about. And I always tell this, like, use the example of, I calculate it in terms of, like, if, when I get laid off, how long can I live in a Marriott hotel by an airport? And it's a long time right now. So it made too much sense. Yeah. And I'm excited to be at Sportsnet Grill. I want Sportsnet Grill to have, like, a signature cocktail after each personality. Okay. You know? I want to order a DaVidi on the rocks. You know, I want to order a tall Murphy here.
Yeah.
You know, come on.
The Julia Kreutz would just be a glass of Prosecco.
It was I actually had a Julia Kreutz the other evening because I was out of whiskey, which really is the actual answer to how this week is going. And I looked over in the bar and there was a beautiful glowing bottle of cachaça, so I enjoyed that on the rocks and it was delicious.
Nice. So in addition to Sportsnet Grill, on Thursday after Jays Phillies, you guys will also be doing another one June 26th at another Story Bookshop in Raunsea. People can check that out. There are a couple more dates, TBA. And, of course, the book is available, Indigo Chapters, Amazon, and, you know, preferred, check out your local bookshop as well because they will be scattered around those places as well.
I love it. Can't be waiting to be in conversation with Julia Kreutz.
It's called
our first time in conversation with. I feel like I should really wear a tie to that event. But
we should start practicing.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Are you gonna dress up? Are you gonna wear a tie, Julia?
You kind of have to, right? I've never worn a tie before.
I keep getting that question from my friends because they just hear book event, and it sounds very, you know, like that.
Yeah, the Winnie the Pooh meme.
Yeah,
him with a T-shirt and no pants in the jar of honey,
exactly.
And then him in a suit.
I'm going to a book event. Please don't dress nice. Yeah. Dress normally.
I'm sure that also, you know, just the pomp and circumstance of going on a book tour is more glamorous than actually writing the book itself. But I did want to ask you about the process of writing the book, Keegan. It did seem from where I was sitting that it kind of happened fast, but it was a lot. I guess, how would you describe the process of reporting and talking to people, you know, putting it all on the page and then seeing the final product now?
Yeah, it was a process of learning it on the fly, too, because this was all new to me. And I'm very used to showing up to the stadium and writing a 700-800-word story and going home and drinking a beer and going to bed. Like, I can do that with my eyes closed. It's not easy, but it's normal to me. This started at the Ohtani winter meetings in Nashville in 2023. I was in the midst of, like, negotiating and signing the deal then, and there were agents and publishers involved while all of the Ohtani stuff was going on. So I was really in a good place mentally. and while all that was happening, this started. The real work would have started kind of February, March of last year in spring training. But a lot of this was screwing up and learning how to structure it, number one, because when you approach a project like this, the history of the Blue Jays, they've been around 49 years, despite how this looks on TV. I'm not yet 49. And a lot of this has happened before me, or even the World Series years. I was alive, barely. I don't remember them. So a lot of the process of this book was deciding what to write and how to write it. And I keep saying the important word is curated, you know, because if this was a history of the Blue Jays, the book would suck, number one. Nobody would enjoy it. And it would have to be 10,000 pages long. It's just, you can't do that. So the decision, I guess, or the freedom to be sort of picky was important in all of this. And from there, as you know, from sitting next to me in the press box, I handled it really well. I was calm. Mm-hmm. I didn't melt down. I didn't say a curse word all of 2024. Mm-hmm. But it was amazing, the process to go through this. A long summer. This book was written in more hotels and bars and airplanes than I can count. But that's the fun part of it. You know, I have so many memories of every chapter, where I was, the conversations I had for it. And that means a lot to me because it feels pretty closely tied to my life the last year and a half. And this is a big moment of just like, finally. And for people listening at home, if I am sick of this book at this point, this person here is number two. She has read it enough, more than anyone, and has been around the orbit of this book plenty. So it's just fantastic to have this actually in people's hands.
It's funny that you say you remember where you were when you wrote each chapter or whatever it is, because I had it in November. You asked me to give it a read and give it an edit and things like that, which is important to have friends, right, to do that. And it was around the time I was leaving for Thailand for a month. And I also have memories, very distinct memories, of which airport I was at when I was editing certain chapters, and which, you know, a plane to where, when the Allison Gordon chapter was a big one, mm-hmm. where I just handed it over to Maxine. I said, you got to read this. This is so, right? So it's a striking book. There's a lot there that is very, very memorable. And it's nice to see that it feels like that for you as well. And I'm sure we can get into some of the specifics of certain chapters here. There's a lot of good stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I will say that Julia's edits were quite pointed. some of them tiptoed into the realm of being rude, I believe, at one point. I could tell which point of her. Now, one might also say asking a friend to edit your book while they're about to travel to Thailand is a bit rude itself. But some of Julia's edits were not subtle. A lot of it was something highlighted.
Yeah.
And it would say, like, bleeping, really, Keegan? And that's when I knew I'd really made a mistake. But they were all very effective.
We got here. This is the final product for sure.
So everyone should read the book, and some of the chapters will be familiar to you. Mm-hmm. Some of them will not be. Before we get into the familiar and unfamiliar, this is the only personal question I have for you about the writing of the book, because we've talked about it a lot off air, and your East Coast knowledge of lobster anatomy. Did you ever think that would make its way into some of your baseball writing?
Never, never. And that was one of those happy moments for me in the process of writing the book. And for people who will read this is in the Sky Dome chapter. And I didn't know how to make Sky Dome interesting. I'm fascinated by it, and I do think it's an interesting building and structure and history, but I didn't know the right angle. And I found deep, deep, deep in some search an old History Channel documentary about Sky Dome. Oh. And speaking with one of the architects on that documentary, at one point he said the idea was like the back of a crustacea, the back of a lobster, as the shells moved with the body. And that was the moment of, like, I was cursing at the computer, so happy I had just found this. Because, no, I did not think that I'd be able to wedge it in. I probably planned to wedge it in. Thankfully, I didn't have to be as clunky with it this time. But that was a special one, man. And I enjoyed the Sky Dome chapter a lot, because I learned a lot about the Sky Dome during that. And it's a building where I spend too much time anyways. But every time I see it open and close now, I think of that.
Yeah, a lobster shell just kind of retracting and
beautiful.
Whatever the opposite of retracting is, I don't know.
You can't unsee it, though. It's, yeah. It's the thing.
It is. It's pretty fascinating. Yeah, glad you got to dust off a little of the East Coast knowledge. I have read most of the book so far. I don't know if your golf background gets into it at all. I don't. Ernie Clement
much.
Probably has a chapter if you write the book after last weekend. Then if you, but maybe not just yet. So from I guess I'll I've asked you this off air, but I will leave this up to you because your audience who has followed your work and heard you on the show all the time will be familiar with some of what's already in here, the Shohei Chase and things like that. What made it into the book that maybe hasn't made it into your everyday reporting that you think fans will be particularly interested to read about or maybe even surprised by?
Yeah, those are the fun parts because I had to write the Joe Carter home run, but I think people have written that before once or twice. The fresh things are what excited me. A lot of that is Ohtani and what's in that chapter, some stuff I saved, and some of it survived the year and a half without getting out there, I think. But the COVID year chapters were pretty special for me because I spent a lot of those years on the road. Some of it as one of just a couple media members, a lot of it as just myself, whether that was in Dunedin or Buffalo. And going back through that, I realized how much I had kind of turned my brain off in that time covering the team. And it felt like I was writing a story about someone else's experience, to be honest with you. The amount of time I spent in Buffalo, which I'm good without for a little while longer. And the amount of time I spent in Dunedin, especially those spring trainings with nobody there. There were spring games with no broadcast where it was just me sitting there. Some days I would have Ben Wagner or Buck Martinez five seats down because they lived locally. But there were entire days, entire games that were just my eyeballs. And it's strange to revisit that and kind of the life that went into all of that. Travel life, the quarantine life that went into that. Some others are more about players' lives around this city, whether it's their experiences being famous in this city from fringe guys like a Ryan Goins or a Kevin Pillar fan favorite to the famous ones like Jose Bautista. I still remember sitting, it was about 7 in the morning, we were at a City Connects event, sitting with Jose Bautista. And it was the morning after the City Connect launch party, so I was just, like, really clear-eyed. 7 a.m. interview after an open bar. But I remember asking Jose about being famous in the city, and he just paused and looked out in the field, and he said, "Well, Keegan, I can't say it was quite like the Michael Jackson treatment, but it was the Michael Jackson treatment." And just in this way that only he can say, you know? So some of their experiences, those are questions I don't have a spot to ask guys in the year. Same as the chapter about coming to Canada. You know, speaking to Kevin Gausman about that was pretty fun. And his decision, what went into that when it really, really, really looked like he was going to be a Met, which would have sucked for this organization.
And his, if I'm remembering the chapter right, was during the you can only really visit via Zoom era too, right? So you're trying to sell a guy on these things without being able to take him and physically show him.
Yeah, and the Gausman story was that he and his wife were at what he called a wellness retreat where you are not supposed to have your phone on you whatsoever. And he kept getting in trouble for having his phone.
Very White Lotus season
was,
three of it.
It was. And he would be an elite character on the White Lotus. But those were fun because those are chapters that don't show up night to night. Because I'm going to show up to the game tomorrow. The Jays will win 5-2 or lose 6-3, whatever. And I can't go down and ask those questions. So the book itself, and I actually use this example for a couple of Sportsnet's finest, man, Dan Shulman and Buck Martinez, the last two chapters. Mm-hmm. And I see them every day. But writing a book gives you an excuse to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to ask you some stuff I normally wouldn't while we're hanging in the hallway. And those felt special to me. I those ones really meant a lot to me.
That's one that I wanted to ask you about a bit more in depth, Keegan, because you're right. We see them every day. We small talk every day, right? You're in the clubhouse and you're chatting, but it does seem like there's a lot to learn, not just about Dan and Buck as individual people, but also about their relationship, their friendship. How much more appreciation, I guess, do you have for what they do now after having those conversations with them?
Oh, so much, because as you both know much better than me, talking for an hour a day is pretty hard when it moves to 2 hours a day. Is this the first week of 2 hours a day?
Second week.
It's probably more than twice as hard.
Yes.
So covering the game, talking that much each and every night, just from a baseline level, fascinates me. The ability to do that without losing your voice, without running out of things to say, fascinates me. And this is in the book, but I can't say it enough, that like I hope people realize how fortunate they are to have Dan Shulman and Buck Martinez with Joe Siddall moving into the booth sometimes too as your broadcast team in your home market. That's ridiculous.
It comes up all the time on this show. Amazing. Where like someone from out of market will be on and it'll come up. Ben Clemens from Fangraphs the other day just like went on an aside. Yeah. But like, oh yeah, so I was checking the first couple innings of this Jays game out. Like, you guys are so spoiled. Yeah. It's like, we sure are.
It's unbelievable. But their careers and how they got here. I mean, the bounces along the way. And even when I gave Dan his book there, one of my favorite stories that he told was the day he tried out for the broadcast. And there was an opening, and Buck back then, Buck's been on this broadcast forever on multiple networks across multiple eras. And when Dan was trying out, of course, Buck's reactions over the years, he was so honest about things, even going back to when he was traded to the Blue Jays. And I can't read his full quote on this air, but it was a reaction of like, seriously, Toronto? And his reaction when Dan Shulman tried out for the broadcast was, really, the radio guy? Like, this young radio guy? Are you serious? But it worked out. And these two guys have been tied to each other and have come back to one another on broadcasts over the years. But it's special to have them together, honestly. And sitting down to write that chapter about Buck meant the world to me, man, because he's such a special person. If he's not on the level of excellence, man, I'll climb up there. I'll write it on myself. It's just such a career, such a voice, such a character, man. And Dan said it best, man. There's just something about Buck that connects with people. Like, he's my mom's favorite guy. He's all of our parents, our aunts, our uncles. Everyone loves Buck, and that's not by accident.
And the voice is now just, like, synonymous with baseball here. I can't speak for everyone, but for me, it's like, if I could hear, like, I don't know, it's minus 30 and it's a blizzard, and for, like, if Buck's on a commercial or something like that, I'm like, okay, baseball time. Let's go. Give me a bat. Give me a glove. Let me sit down and watch innings. Man. It's awesome. I'm glad you got to do that. Did you pitch the publisher on, I should probably go down to Panama on his fishing boat for a couple days to tell this chapter?
I've been trying to. We need bigger budgets in publishing. But, man, when you get Buck going about fishing, the rest of your day is done. And the stories Buck can tell, too. And Buck's been causing me some headaches lately, I'll tell you, because I collect baseball cards. I love to collect baseball cards. I'm very neurotic about it. And organizing them and my spreadsheets brings me even more joy than the cards themselves. But one of my projects on the side right now is collecting a baseball card for every single name mentioned in the book.
Okay.
Which is just a little thing that I've started up, and I really enjoy it. And I swear Buck added 150 names to that with his stories. Every story would be, well, I was down in Chattanooga in 1979, and Billy McKinstry and this guy and that guy were there, and I'm looking up, okay, this guy played in single A for a year. He has such an incredible memory for these stories and these names, so he's sending me some goose chases with these.
That's a tough one. So you mentioned you are a baseball card guy, and the spreadsheet thing, I imagine, is a more recent addition. I know you're a spreadsheet guy like I am. I was a big baseball and hockey card guy as a kid, and it was all about organizing in the binder and stuff like this. And where I'm going with this is, again, I know you don't want to make the focus too much about yourself, but I think a nice thing about a book like this, especially the introduction, is people read your stuff every day. They see your tweets on Twitter. They hear you come on here with us. But there's never really a space for someone in a job like yours to be like, this is my baseball story. Yeah. This is my connection to the team. And I wonder how much that part of this process meant to you and just kind of, you know, reshaped, if it did at all, your relationship with the job and with the career, kind of getting to go back and reflect on your own relationship with baseball and with the Toronto Blue Jays.
It did, because my relationship was bad with it, honestly. And that comes from a couple of places. Number one is just work. Doing this, talking about sports all day, it looks really cool. But anybody in any job, you can get bitter, you can get tired and cranky, and real life seeps in. And for a lot of teams, or a lot of years covering this team, it's, you know, real life has crept in on me. When I'm not happy outside of the ballpark, it's hard to be happy inside it. And you kind of take that out on the game itself, you know, and it becomes work. And I've made that mistake over the years a lot of times. And it made me think about the types of stories I write. And I started covering this team in 2017, so the party was over. Oh. You know, I'm the kiss of death. Maybe if they get rid of me, things will go better. But that means that I have written about losses, And if I were to sit down and lay out the 10 stories I think I wrote the best or that I'm proudest of, probably 9 of them are about negative moments, like sad moments. They're postseason losses. They're the Ohtani chase, the Soto or Sasaki. Like, they're about bad things. And that made me kind of reconsider my relationship with the job. Now, I still have to write those when they happen, but it also taught me that I haven't written much about joy, and that's a very hard thing to write about. Because sadness, like negative moments like that, when I walk into a clubhouse that's just gone wrong, that sits right in front of you. Or when a player blows their knee, or if they have a terrible stretch, they get optioned, they have to retire. Like, that's right there in front of you. It lets you look at it. But joy bounces around the room, man. It makes sounds. It changes shapes. Like, it's a very hard thing to write about those moments, postseason success. So to speak to these players about all-time great moments, about the bat flip, about Joe Carter's walk-off, about the glory years, that's a different challenge. And it made me realize I don't do it enough, and I haven't been able to do it enough. And that got me excited about it again, man. It kind of helped me step back from the day-to-day, like, so, Chris, your cutter didn't cut as much today. Who cares? 5 people. But it got me back to really my love of baseball. And I overcorrected earlier in my career because, you know, we're not supposed to cheer for teams in this job. And I took that too far as, like, I need to be fully detached. Don't touch it. I don't care what happens. Even if somebody hits a 5-run home run, I'm just going to grunt at it and write a story. That's not healthy anymore. So I think this book has really, really changed my relationship with baseball. And it's, despite making me miserable at a lot of points, it's left me a lot happier, which is an interesting dynamic. But it's really helped patch up how I feel about the game. And I fully love it again. You know, it's been refreshing. Because, I mean, you know, Julia sat next to me in that press box too long. There are days where I'm butting heads with the game, and this has really helped fix that. So I'm grateful to it.
And we kind of, you know, could see it coming too in bits and pieces. Even last year, Keegan, I remember one of the many Bowden Francis near no-hitters in which you just stepped away for a bit of a walk, and you came back and you brought me, I don't keep score when I'm watching it, but you brought me a scorecard, yeah. Right? Or it's like, listen,
that's a good example.
We don't know what's going to happen here. We should have this. You had one for yourself and one for me. Even going back to 23, I think it was, when the Blue Jays clinched a playoff spot and we were on the field and they were celebrating, and you came over to me and you just said, hey, we should enjoy this.
Yeah.
This is what it's about. You know, and so it's been in motion, and it's nice to see that we're here now.
Yeah.
And before we take a break, if I may, I just wanted to ask you, you know, as you look at this iteration of the Blue Jays and the fact that there has been so much heartbreak, like you said, but then you also got to report on the many times where it went right, whether that's the World Series runs or 2015, 2016. Do you look at this group, at this core, in any different way, having, you know, gone a little deeper in all of the success in the past?
I do, because it's made me realize how quickly a person can become something more than just a person. Like, how quickly a person can become a moment that lasts absolutely forever. There's an alternate reality where Joe Carter's just a good veteran RBI guy who we kind of remember, cool. But he lives the rest of his life unable to have a single conversation without talking about a home run. If the Blue Jays can sneak into the postseason and go on a run, and it doesn't have to be Vladdy, it can be some guy batting 7th, hits a home run at the right time, their life changes. We talk about it forever. I write a chapter about it someday. And suddenly the last 9 years, going back to 2017 when I showed up, disappears. And prior to 92 and 93, the Jays were that good team through the 80s that was never good enough. That all got wiped away pretty quickly. Not completely, but it changed everything. I think it made me appreciate and understand better how, like, one moment can absolutely change an entire organization, can change lives, can change a team, and it can make everything that happened before it live in a much different light. So I think I'm a little less dire about this era. And I've been asked, too, like, where's the chapter on the Atkins and Shapiro, this era, the Vladdy and Bo era? It isn't over.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maybe I should have written that chapter, because then they would have won the World Series this year, just to kind of stick it to me. But that one's not over yet.
Yeah.
And because I'm a big believer that if they get it all together, go on a run, and someone hits a home run at the right time, we look at all of this as the buildup, not the disappointment.
Right, and it's such an interesting thing narratively where right this second we can only evaluate the transactions that happen it through that lens, and it shouldn't change it. If something has a 20% chance of working out and it works out, think draft lottery. You're an NBA guy. It doesn't change the decision-making along the way, but it definitely changed the narrative hook. And as someone who covered the Raptors championship and the lead up to that, by the way, if you want to have a really messed up relationship between the job and your fandom, go from being a fan to writing about the team where you're supposed to remove the fandom and then also be freelance for like 6 years. So your income and your earning potential is directly tied to how well the team does. So like, I'm not supposed to be a fan anymore, but I won't be able to afford my rent if they get knocked out in the first round against the Indiana Pacers. That's when your relationship with it will get really mucked up. No, that's all really well said, Keegan. Seems like a natural spot for a break. When we go back, we'll talk a little bit about this team, which is on a 5-game winning streak, which hopefully is a good way to foster excitement, sell some books, and get the Sportsnet grill popping on Thursday after they take 2 or 3 against the Philadelphia Phillies. Keegan Matheson is going to stay with us as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy, Julia Kreutz, and Keegan Matheson with you. Keegan's still hanging around because the franchise, A Curated History of the Toronto Blue Jays, is out tomorrow. And really, you can get it wherever you get your books right now, either on last-minute pre-order or because a lot of places are already stocked up with them. And what a way to sell a book like a 5-game winning streak. We had joked about it a million times, and I wasn't actually even that sure because you could tell me the excitement around the team, everything's really good. That's a good way to sell a book. You could also tell me if the team were just like in the absolute dumpster and be like, 2015, 2016 stories, 1992, 1993 stories. Remember why you like baseball and buy this book. How are you feeling after a 5-game win streak?
Man, I have changed how I'm going to market the book every 5 days this season. And I've done exactly what you just said. There's lots of times where it'll be mentioned on the air and I'll say, well, this is a story about why you do care about this team. Don't forget right now. But I should have booked the schedule. Whoever decided to release this book after a 4-game series against the A's, God bless them. But this is the best the team has looked all year to me. And I said that after that Padres series probably as well. But this is 4 in a row. And only a small part of me cares that it's the A's. I mean, whatever. You're supposed to beat up on bad teams. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they did. It's all about the offense for me. I think pretty much across the board, I think the rotation's going to be good enough. I think the bullpen's pretty good. It's all about the offense. And what you saw from that group with Ernie Clement and Addison Barger was exciting. And beyond the metrics and the numbers and the wins, it was watchable baseball. I mean, it was fun, watchable baseball, which there has not been a ton of this season. And they're finally getting a little separated from that 500 mark, which they have been frustratingly stuck to.
It was a messy series, which makes for fun baseball, right? Mm-hmm. For all the talk about, you know, playing sharp and tightening up on the fundamentals and all of that. Really, if you swing the bat and you score 3 runs at once, you can afford to be a little bit sloppy. That's kind of what we saw against the A's here.
Well, you can afford to be a little bit sloppy. You can afford to have your closer and Jeff Hoffman sputter a little bit or Chad Green sputter a little bit because you're not pitching with a 1-run lead. You're pitching with a 3-run lead or a 4-run lead. Yeah. That helps a lot. Watch me tie all this in.
I like it.
So, a lot of offense on the weekend. On Friday, there could have been even more offense. Were it not for the player in this series who's probably most likely to appreciate this book because he grew up as a big fan of the Toronto Blue Jays in the 2006 to 2010 dead era, we'll say. Denzel Clark of the Athletics made his Major League debut the other week, was in Toronto. We got to talk to him Thursday. He was down to remember some guys from that era. He's talking Aaron Hill, Johnny Mack, Rod Barajas.
Oh, baby.
He mentioned that his earliest Rogers Center memory is sitting in the 200 level right below the Carlos Delgado sign for an Aaron Hill walk-off. I did not follow up. It could have been a 2006 or a 2010 Aaron Hill walk-off. As fate would have it, he hit a home run Saturday to exactly the spot that he had did. Well, not exactly, but very close to the spot that he had described sitting in. I bring Denzel Clark up because he also was the reason the Blue Jays didn't have a little more offense on Friday. He robbed Alejandro Kirk of a leadoff home run in the fourth.
Dalton Varsho style.
Yes.
Climbing the wall.
And Julia, you gave me some homework.
I did.
Around that.
Because it was weird. I think, was I there? I don't remember where I was watching that game from, but I did look at the research tool type of thing. For
that's not homework you can give me. Where was I watching the game?
She's declining with old age.
Blake usually knows, though, you know? Yeah.
Like, I know you were at the game Saturday and Sunday because I heard you pregame for both of them while I was walking around.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Anyway, yeah, you look at the research tool, that catch had a 95% catch probability. And that is when you fire up the group chat and you ask Blake, what the heck is going on here?
So my first response to that catch having a 95% catch probability, no, it didn't. I don't care what StatCast says. Mike Petriello, show yourself. Like, we'll have this out. No, it did technically have a 95% catch probability. So I did look into this, and the way this stuff works, and I've said on the show before, I don't love catch probability as a stat. I think people use it a bit as a crutch, similar to expected batting average. You know, to kind of just like wave away. And like that stuff is super useful. Once we have like 200 plate appearances and we can see something like Bo Bichette would be expected to have a 500 slugging and he's slugging 400, we can pretty safely say he's had a bit of bum luck. Catch probability, you look at a season's worth of data and it says Dalton Varsho leads the league in this. Like, okay, that backs up my eye test. For individual ones, though, we've had a few of the statsy people. There's a woman named Vivian who is a Red Sox person. She does a lot of like the physics-based modeling and stuff like that. And she's basically shown that the outs above average, the StatCast catch probability, underestimates the difficulty of difficult catches. In this case, it gives Denzel Clark a 95% catch probability because of where he was positioned when the ball was hit. He was 322 feet deep, so he has only 80 feet to cover. He has a lot of time. The ball hangs up, so he has 6 seconds to make this catch in which he travels 80 feet, and it's going backwards, which we know is easier than going in at like a low line or something like that. So it takes into account that and says 95% catch probability. For whatever reason, it doesn't account for the fact that there is a wall in the way and that he has to Spider-Man up the wall and reach over the wall to make the catch. I don't know how we model that in, but yeah, that was a home run in 11 out of 30 ballparks. It had a 770 expected batting average on that one, and it went 407 feet. So I'm going to say the catch probability on that one was like at most 5%. Yeah. And I think if you are not as smooth and athletic as Denzel Clark, who, by the way, is just like so smooth in center field. Like that guy is going to break catch probability because everything looks so easy for him. Anyway, all of this is to say there's a reason I've said before I don't like it as a stat for individual catches. That one is egregious enough that like they got to reevaluate if there's a wall in the way of your catch probability, you know?
Yeah, we have enough fancy computers to account for walls, I think, at this point.
Yeah, seriously.
But he is so good. He almost made that one going back into left center. Was that on a Lucas line drive to the wall where he slammed into it? That was amazing.
That couple one stolen had a 5% bases, yes. Yeah. Catch probability.
There you go.
But, again, a wall in the way.
I guess it
how about that,
out.
Nerds?
Yeah, a couple stolen bases for him as well. He could do nothing about Addison Barger, though.
Man. There's no climbing walls there.
Yes. You would have to, like, you know, in Major League, when the guy they acquire from the Tokyo Giants runs up the wall, stands on top of it, and makes a catch like that, that wouldn't even be enough. Where are you at with Addison Barger right now? He's obviously a guy you've talked about a bunch, even when he was on his way up as a prospect, because he was so notable for the tool side. You ready to say he's locked in as everyday guy for you, given what he's been able to show this year?
For now, yeah. And I've been slow on Barger. Like, I got to be honest about that, because when you can hit the ball as hard as anyone in the organization, and you can throw the ball harder than half the pitching staff, and you can run fast, and you're built like that, and it still hasn't come together in the big leagues when you're getting to be 23, 24, I often think there's a reason for that, because a player has not put it all together. But we are seeing right now in Barger what happens when that does all come to click. And that's about the mental game for Barger. And I think this has been a lesson for me that a mental game means something way different for different people. Like when you go back through the last great teams, like Jose's and Edwin's and Donaldson's and Tulo's and Martin's mental games, we're all a little bit different. For some guys, that means being extremely intricate and understanding every angle and velocity and stat that I've never heard of. And for Barger, man, I remember listening or being at one of his games, covering it when he really broke out a couple of weeks ago. And I asked, you know, where's your confidence coming from? Like, what's allowing you to do this? And he just looked at me and said, I'm chilling out. I said, okay, this is a bit simpler.
Yeah.
And some players just have a lot going on mentally. And when that quiets down, it allows these incredible physical skills to show themselves. Now, this is going to be a big adjustment for him as well, because the next few pitching staffs are going to look at what he's doing to pitchers and say, I don't want that to happen to me. And we'll see if he adjusts. There are always examples like David Schneider of incredible early success, and then pitchers make a big adjustment. What gives me optimism with Barger, though, is that as long as he is kind of keeping up mentally with those adjustments, his body will allow him to catch up. If he's pitched differently, his bat will get there. I don't think he has those big gaping holes in his swing. It's been more about the mental adjustments and putting it together. And you're seeing an incredible baseball player right now, like a game-changing player. And this team has been a bat away all year. And if Barger can be that bat, that's what changes a 500 team into a team that can win 90 games. Like, you just need one thing to go really, really right.
Yeah, that opens up some opportunities and possibilities for sure. You say one bat away, Blue Jays lost two this weekend. Anthony Santander was not really contributing to the degree that the Blue Jays expected, of course, but Dalton Varsho had been such a spark plug since coming back from injury. And now, you know, kind of here we are again type of thing, Keegan. But do we expect Addison Barger to play a little bit in the outfield here? We've been going back and forth on that. He's been so good at third. How do you see the outfield configuration moving forward?
I see a lot more Barger in right field, a lot more George Springer DH. I think the other day Schneider said it would be 50-50 is cool. And probably best for George Springer too, 35 going on 36. He's been out there a lot. And he's been on the bases running a lot, which is a byproduct of getting on base a little bit, so that's okay. But I think you see Barger there a lot more. Ernie Clement at third base all the time when it's a lefty, sometimes when it's a righty. But I don't think you can make Andrés Giménez anything other than a full-time player right now still. I know the bat needs to come along, but his defense is so valuable. So it's a bit of a good problem, but I'm curious really where Alan Rodon fits in here, how you get him at bats. The outfield has been and still is extremely crowded, but I think right field is going to almost solely belong to Springer and Barger at this point. I've loved how he looks at third base, again, because he's calmed down. Mm-hmm. Like, you're seeing him take a breath before making that wild throw. He's an extremely accurate thrower, which surprises me. Those big, strong-armed guys are normally kind of scattershoot. But he's really, like, he might be the most accurate infield arm on this team. So by calming down there, that makes him a legitimate option. And third base is supposed to be a power position. I know the game is changing, but I'm still tied to the traditional, you know, like, I'm a guy that likes a big 19 rebound, 4-point center, you know? Like, I guess I'm stuck in the 80s in most of my sports, but I love to see power from third base. And I think the Jays have needed more power from there and from their corner outfielders for a long, long, long time. So Barger needs to be in the lineup every day. Everything else can change around him, but he represents the upside they need. I think he's got to be in there every day.
So Barger splitting time right field, third base, Ernie Clement and Andrés Giménez filling second and third, and maybe one Vlad DH day in there, and we get to see Ernie Clement at first base again just because it's amusing. The other outfield spot, so no Dalton Varsho. It sounds like it's going to be something close to a straight platoon between Nathan Lucas and Miles Straw. And yeah, then I guess that leaves Jonathan Clase, Alan Rodon, and either David Schneider or Michael Stefanik, depending on who they option down when Giménez comes off the IL, for the left field reps. Does that sound about right to you?
It does. And Clase has changed this a little bit by a bit of a good run himself. You do still see some of that mental game needing to come together for his really impressive tools. Incredibly fast player, really gifted on the bases, but can sometimes overrun those bases or get a little too amped up in those situations. So I think that Nathan Lucas playing like he has, and all credit to Nathan Lucas, because I was wrong about him. I did not think that he could raise the ceiling like this, and he's taken another step in his game at 30, and that's really, really impressive. But adding Clase to that, needing to find some reps for Alan Rodon against right-handed pitching, Rodon is, for me, a similar argument to Barger in that you need to just believe in his talents And the Blue Jays need to kind of bet on themselves and trust themselves with that, because they don't just love Allen Rodon. They're head over heels, obsessed with that guy, going back through spring training, and they should be. Now, it's the same reason they kept going back to Addison Barger, despite him getting 69 games last year that weren't all that impressive, is because they see those physical tools and they believe in them. I think they still need to believe in Allen Rodon's tools, because he's now able to come back and exhale. Okay, you know where you're staying now. You know how to get around the city. Now, life is normal now for Allen Rodon, or a little more normal in Toronto. And I really believe in his skill set in this lineup. So any opportunity you have to get him at bats, I think even a lot of the times over Class A, I'd be very eager to do so. But like you said, a bit of a loose platoon in center. We'll see if Class A gets a little bit of there. But I want to see more Allen Rodon than the average guy, maybe, I think, at this point, because he's still a really impressive ball player.
And did everything he could when he went down to AAA. Yeah. 18 games down there, had an OPS over 1,000. Walked more than he struck out, which you know this front office is going to circle that and highlight it when they send the report into you know, whoever's making the lineup card. 8% strikeout rate when he went down to AAA. Yeah. That I mean, we'll have to see the major league sample before we really, but I think it's pretty safe that he's done at AAA. Like, he's whether he actually goes down there or not again, in terms of what he needs to learn down there, I think he's learned it. Yeah, always.
The development is kind of complete at that level. And at some point, you, like Keegs said, you kind of need to believe in the guy here. And we saw that from Barger. We really did. It took him a bit, but his development did continue once he got here this year and was able to play every day and show what he has.
Yes. Okay, we've got about 3 minutes left. We talked almost no pitching from the weekend.
Seriously.
Chris Bassett a little too hard on himself. Kevin Gausman was actually better than the results. The splitter movement was great again. Got a lot of swing and miss. Some called strike with the fastball. Just the one mistake he made, in his own estimation, cost him. But Keegan, the one thing I wanted to ask you before we go out here, Jimmy Garcia is down. We don't have an update on him. Yariel Rodriguez has pitched pretty damn good in a relief role and even in a semi-leverage role. Has he worked his way up to the eighth inning for you? And even like as Jeff Hoffman figures it out here, we saw Jimmy Garcia get some save opportunities on nights Jeff Hoffman wasn't available. Is your confidence level that high with leverage Yariel Rodriguez?
Absolutely. Let him close if Hoffman's down, 100%. Because I love a player who fits their position in terms of their personality and their energy. And my God, does Yariel Rodriguez fit coming out of the bullpen, dripping sweat, ready to yell at somebody and beat his chest after he strikes them out. It's perfect. It's a beautiful fit. And he has risen to those big moments. He likes them. You know, going into the season, he was still saying, I prefer starting a little bit, but I'll do this, and I know how to do it. It seems like he's really embracing it here, and he can rise to those big moments. He's controlling the ball a little bit better now and giving himself advantageous counts, and you see him jumping off and pumping the fist there. Like, I love the showman of Yariel Rodriguez, and if he can be a legitimate eighth-inning guy, that contract looks great. Like, fine, no problem. And if Hoffman needs a day, either because he pitched the day before or you just want to give him a bit of extra rest, which I think would be wise, roll out Yariel Rodriguez. And especially if Eric Swanson can step into that role behind him, that's big. But Rodriguez has been a huge success. Like, credit to him, credit to Pete Walker, because finding that level of value changes the bullpen completely. It's kind of like Barger for the lineup. He's Yariel for the bullpen.
Yeah, throw your fastball 2 miles an hour harder. Throw your slider a lot more, because guys don't get a second look at it, and you don't have to worry about your arm blowing out quite as quickly. It's a pretty good mix for a reliever. And yeah, Eric Swanson back in the mix as well. Easton Lucas option down, and Jose Urena DFA. Couple quick notes. Spencer Turnbull started at AAA. It didn't go very well, but that gives us the answer on the decision of whether he'd start next at AAA or A. The clock is ticking on that one to get him to the majors. Andrés Giménez, Tyler Heineman were in rehab games all weekend, expected to return to the team on Tuesday. Max Scherzer facing live hitters again on Tuesday. Allen Rodon, Michael Stefanik, and Ali Sanchez will have a cool story to tell later in their career that they helped Max Scherzer get back up to speed in his return from the thumb thing. No other major updates other than my guy Yohindrik Pinango got the bump to AAA with Davis Schneider and Allen Rodon getting the bump to the majors. He has been very Davis-y, actually. Really good batted ball stuff, exit velocity. Maybe he's not, doesn't have the loft to be a 30 home run guy, but he is a prospect of interest. We will be back tomorrow We got a loaded show. Joe Siddall's going to join us. We'll set up the Philly series with Ryan Dempster. This is a Philly series that 7 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and a lot of good pitching. Zach Wheeler, Christopher Sanchez, and McAble, who you might not be familiar with, but came up from the minors and looked awesome last time out. The book is The Franchise, A Curated History of the Toronto Blue Jays by Keegan Matheson. It is out tomorrow with a launch party Thursday at Sportsnet Grill. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks, Keegan. Thanks, Carlos Pena. Have a wonderful Monday.